is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and I welcome a great privilege, Professor Nicholas Thomas, Professor of Historical Anthropology at the University of Cambridge, Director of the Cambridge Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, to help me with his new book, Wonderful Story About the Pacific Rim Basin, where I've been several times in my life, ignorant of the questions I didn't know existed about where this wonderful culture came from that I visited in Hawaii, where it's going now in the 21st century, given its history. The new book is Voyagers, The Settlement of the Pacific. Professor, a very good evening to you. Thank you very much. Congratulations. And I take you to a moment in your explication of the vastness of this landscape called Oceania. This is, I believe, 1821. A missionary, John Williams, is deploying Christianity throughout the islands, the Cook Group, if I read correctly. And at one point, he comes across a chief, Rongo Matani, who offers to demonstrate to him how to sail to the next point where he wants to go. And herein lies the secret of the vast voyages across the Oceania. What do we need to know about what Rongo Matani told John Williams that he recorded so dutifully in the early 19th century? Good evening, Professor.
Good evening, and it's a pleasure to talk to you. And John Williams himself was actually a fascinating character. I mean, people often think missionaries must be narrow-minded, dogmatic, just out away from Europe to try to convert people. And John Williams was in some ways like that, but he was also somebody who had a great ability to build rapport with islands people in the Pacific. He listened to them. He was interested in what they had to say. He was interested in their knowledge. And this is really a case in point. He was in search of the largest island in the Cook Islands archipelago, Rarotonga. He had heard of it. He had heard of the population. He knew it was a great Pacific Island society, and he was immensely eager to reach that island and see what he could do to persuade the inhabitants to adopt Christianity. He counted himself as an explorer, as well as a missionary, but he had a deep awareness that he couldn't get to the places he wanted to visit without local aid and advice. And the particular trick, I guess, he picked up from Rongo Matane was that it really mattered where you departed from, so that in a European cartographic system, that's somewhat arbitrary. You trace your course from wherever your vessel happens to be located. But for navigators right across the Pacific, a departure point was critical, a particular point on an island where landmarks such as hills or even artificially raised markers like standing stones set the course. They enabled a direction. And so Williams understood that he had to take his ship to this particular point and orient it properly. And he was standing on the deck of the ship as it was sort of circled around. And at a certain point, the chief said, "This is right." And so at that point, in the middle of the day, they were pointing in the right direction, and they ventured out into what, so far as Williams knew, was open ocean. But by the time they had lost sight of land, by the time they'd lost sight of those landmarks, the stars were rising, and it was then possible for the Polynesian navigators on board to orient the vessel on the basis of the stars.
Yes, here is the magic and the science, what we call science, the gift passed down over thousands of years. And there are three details that are necessary to sail without modern European navigation tools. The course setting, which you just established, you wait until you're in exactly the right spot. This would be tradition and knowledge. maintaining the course and making landfall. How did they maintain the course once out of sight of the starting point or of any land? How did they do it, Professor?
Well, that was most fundamentally through the stars. So they would look at stars as they were rising above the horizon, and they would provide points of orientation, and they could follow the particular stars that were relevant. But of course, there's a point where that star becomes too high in the sky to provide any useful bearing. So it's not a question of a single star, it's a question of understanding the constellations and picking up, as it were, the next set of stars that emerge. But there was a very subtle body of knowledge that went along with all of this, because if there were prevailing currents, they would, as it were, push your canoe sideways out of that course, even if you sustained your orientation towards that particular star. So navigators had to understand the seasonal currents, they had to understand the movements of water, they had to understand the strength of wind at any particular time, and they would therefore compensate for that drift off course by shifting their orientation slightly to compensate.
The example you give, the wonderful example is, and I do the best I can with the names of the islands, Woli Eye to Olomaro. The navigation requires you to know where an in-between island is, Farolep, but you never see Farolep. You just maintain the course on the basis of the star at the right time of the year being over Farolep. This is dead reckoning as I've never heard it, Professor. Was this new to the Europeans when they learned this, that you could sail this way?
This understanding on the part of Europeans of indigenous navigational systems really only emerged quite gradually. In the 18th century, when navigators such as Cook realized that Polynesians had the capacity to sail over great distances, it was recognized that they sailed on the basis of a knowledge of the stars. But the detail of that science, of that philosophy, really, because there are, in a sense, abstract models of geography that underpin the understanding, really only emerged after the Second World War, when people, anthropologists and others, went to the trouble of talking closely with islanders in various parts of Micronesia, in the Caroline Islands particularly, who sustained that knowledge at that time, despite all of the changes over the course of colonization, the loss of population, the disruption, Christianity, Second World War, and so on. Remarkably, there were people in Micronesia into the 1960s and 70s who had sustained traditional knowledge, who were able to hand it on to a new generation who had renewed interest in the art of crossing the water. And they helped disseminate that knowledge again, among others such as Hawaiians.
The challenge is, how did they do it? And that is the subject matter in the new book, Voyagers, The Settlement of the Pacific, by Professor Nicholas Thomas of Cambridge University. When we come back to the beginning, well, not the beginning, but certainly from the mainland across Melanesia, Micronesia, all the way to Polynesia, a common culture from pottery. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, Professor Nicholas Thomas, Professor of Historical Anthropology at Cambridge University, also the Director of Archaeology and Anthropology Museum at Cambridge. His new book is Voyagers. And we plunge into the 19th century and are amazed that a chieftain, significant that he's a leadership position in the Cook Islands, this is Polynesia, is able to direct a European sailing master without use of European tools. Now we go back to the beginning, at least until the retreat of the last ice. This is about 11,000 years ago, and we're not in Polynesia. That's well to the east. We're not in Melanesia. We're in Formosa, Taiwan now. And the line, the north-south line called Wallacea. Wallacea, forgive my pronunciation, Professor. What is it that we understand about the voyagers from the mainland into and crossing Wallacea into Melanesia?
There are two stages to this incredible chapter in human history, and it is worth underscoring just how incredible this story is, because otherwise, since the beginnings of human history, since the beginnings of our species, people have been continent-based. So they, of course, anatomically modern humans evolve in Africa, they settle Europe, Asia, and the Americas via a land bridge. So people get around almost everywhere in the world on foot through gradual migrations. But towards the end of the Pleistocene, towards the end of the last great ice age, people in Southeast Asia start to move beyond land, initially through short distance crossings. Wallacea is a set of islands, broadly speaking, between New Guinea and islands Southeast Asia, Java, Borneo. Much of that land was the land was far more extensive during the Ice Age because the sea levels were lower, but there were always deep straits that separated what we call Sunda, that greater Southeast Asian landmass, and islands such as New Guinea. But early on, 50 to 60,000 years ago, people began to cross that channel. We don't really know how or why, but very likely on rafts made of bamboos, they went on to settle New Guinea, huge landmass, extraordinary diverse ecology, and also Australia. And from New Guinea, they began to settle the Solomon Islands and the islands to the north and immediate east of New Guinea. And those passages are extraordinary and unprecedented in human history because it is the first time that people seek to reach new lands, not by making short water crossings, but by going further, by venturing out into the sea. So they're leaving land behind them. Land is out of sight and they still don't see land ahead. But they travel and they eventually find new spaces. And those early migrations are very early. They're about 30,000 years ago. And so we are aware that speakers of what are now called Papuan languages, languages spoken across New Guinea, settled islands in the Solomon's Archipelago by that time. But they don't go further, whereas later on, about five to 6,000 years ago, people who are agriculturalists, people who have clearly a developed culture of travel across water, people who have a maritime orientation, leave Formosa, leave the island, now the nation of Taiwan, travel down again into the island of New Guinea area. And that is where this extraordinary culture, Lapita, known for a distinctive pottery style, people speak what we call Austronesian languages, Malayo-Polynesian languages. They constitute a new kind of voyaging culture and move very swiftly from there through the Solomon Islands into Vanuatu, into New Caledonia, and that part of island Melanesia. And they seem for that period to constitute an intensive culture. They built substantial settlements, linguistic evidence suggests they have socially complex societies. They have chiefs, they have priests, they have specialized roles, they engage in trade. But what is extraordinary is that this is a very rapid set of migrations. Over really just hundreds of years, they leave islands to the north and east of New Guinea and move very swiftly through a range of archipelagos into Vanuatu, New Caledonia, and they venture beyond.
Yes, if I get my dates right, I'm making notes, Professor, forgive me. 43,900 years ago, we have cave art in the Siloese. 32,000 years ago, New Ireland to Buka, we have reason to believe that they crossed, made that passage 109 miles across, 87 to 109 miles across. 9,000 BCE, about 11,000 years ago, they're in the New Guinea highlands. And then we pick up the oceanic culture that we call Lapita from the pottery. And my note says about 2,500 years ago, in other words, 500 BCE. So at that point, that's when we begin to look at the traveling in from New Guinea or that region of New Ireland, New Britain, into the Melanesians and then into Micronesians. So we're looking at about 2,500 years of time in which the investigation is, how did they do it? Why did they do it? Is all that correct, Professor?
Yes, broadly. The chronology is still uncertain. New dates are kind of emerging all the time, but that is broadly correct. And these people reach Eastern Melanesia, Western Polynesia, that is the Fiji, Tonga, Samoa area, and there they settle for a period. So there's this period of rapid migration, the colonization of many islands over a comparatively short period. And then there's a sort of pause where society develops in that Western Polynesia region. And that in a sense, is where Polynesian identity specifically emerges.
Yes, the different identities are important here because when we come back, we're going to go to the 18th century, our forebears here in America and Australia and the rest of the British Empire, because they were voyaging for practical reasons, for investigation. Cook's three voyages had different missions, but we have the notes from Cook's vision of missions, especially one particular, it's not quite a map, I'm learned to call it an archive. And that begins to introduce new mysteries about this vast landscape. This is called Oceania, stretching from the first island chain, which would be Taiwan, the Philippines, down to Australia. Oceania stretches all the way across to an island called Rapa Nui, who I now know is Easter Island. That's well to the east of all this. So we're looking at a transformation of all of these islands to cultures and language groups and sophistication at sea that is still under investigation from Professor Nicholas Thomas and his colleagues, Professor of Historical Anthropology at the University of Cambridge. The book is Voyagers, The Settlement of the Pacific. And when we come back, Captain Cook. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, visiting with Professor Nicholas Thomas. His new book is Voyagers, The Settlement of the Pacific. He's a professor of historical anthropology at the University of Cambridge, and that's what we're doing here, history, but near history. The mystery of Oceania begins with Captain Cook's first, second, and third voyage. Present mysteries to be solved. Professor, who was Captain Cook? Why he was there? Why was he in the Society Islands in 1768? What was his mission?
So Cook was a naval man, but he was above all an exceptionally accomplished surveyor. And that's why the Royal Society and the Admiralty selected him in the 1760s to lead an expedition. The ship was the Endeavour. They went to Tahiti, and the core purpose, certainly the ostensible purpose, was the observation of the transit of Venus. And that observation, that astronomical observation, was scientifically important. It was part of a coordinated set of observations, and the Royal Society and colleagues internationally hoped to be able to measure the distance between the Earth and the Sun. But Cook was also exploring the South Pacific because the British, among other European nations, were very interested to try and establish whether there was a great southern continent. They thought that a great southern continent might be a previously unknown land like China or India. That could be a key trading partner, a huge source of wealth. So the expeditions were about knowledge and geographic discovery, but they were certainly also about empire and the scope for trade and colonization.
On board was Joseph Banks. Who was he, and what does he leave us to know about this first voyage?
Well, Banks was very important to this voyage because it was really one of the first that was scientifically really ambitious. The British Navy had sent out exploratory voyages before. They were typically concerned to map coastlines and territories, but Banks was a natural historian who had a much wider range of interests in botany, animals, people, resources. He was also very wealthy individually, so that even though he was partly funded by the Royal Society, the scientific society of the time, he also used a lot of his own money to pay for a team of assistants, botanists, artists, others. This was really one of the first expeditions that took a scientific team, a research group, a set of people capable of making a very wide range of observations. And Banks was absolutely committed to making the most of the opportunity.
There are many details here to the first, second, and third voyage of Captain Cook, but the one I'm going to focus on, because we're talking about voyages, is the observation of the craft that the Society Island and then the other islanders demonstrated to Endeavour on the first voyage and then the second and third voyage. They saw the craft, but they'd heard of them before from William Dampier, a pirate in the late 17th century. And also, you point to a Dutch warship that came across a large craft that it fired on in the early 17th century. What did Cook make? What did the navigator on board Endeavour and Resolution make of the island crafts?
Cook and other European mariners were really very interested in islanders' canoes, because, of course, being sailors themselves, they were interested in the technical capacities of boats. They were interested in how well they sailed, how fast they could sail, what cargo, how many people they could carry, all of those sorts of very practical aspects. And beginning with Dampier, navigators were astonished by the sophistication of indigenous boats, and they were all the more astonished because people in the Pacific didn't have iron tools. So all of these sailing canoes, often large double-hulled or outrigger canoes, were made completely with stone or shell tools, and the Europeans considered them extraordinarily accomplished, effective boats. Dampier said the Jamoro canoes, the canoes from Guam, were perhaps the finest of any boats in the world. Cook similarly was full of admiration for the sailing capacities of Polynesian canoes. He'd say they are capable of distant navigation, and by that he meant they could sail not just between islands that were within sight of each other, but between archipelagos. They could undertake voyages of hundreds or thousands of miles.
At the same time, they're observing the technology. They're observing common words or similar words, philology, across in these voyages. And you mention other voices, other scholars over this period of time, a Frenchman, D'Urville, and others who have noticed the philological similarity across this vast landscape, suggesting again there was commerce or traveling or voyaging for foundation. All those things are possible. At the same time, the Europeans are imposing their understanding of hierarchy. And it's a treat to see, Professor, how the fashion comes in and out of trying to discern Oceania and its richness. It isn't until we have a book in 1938 from a Maori, Rangi Hiroa, Vikings of the Sunrise, that all this comes together. Do I say correctly that it isn't until the 20th century we come to an understanding of what we're looking at?
Well, one of the remarkable aspects of Cook's voyages is that, especially when he gets to Easter Island, when he gets to Rapa Nui, he immediately recognizes that the people are speaking related languages, and also that they're tattooed, for example, in ways that are not identical to, but related to, say, the tattooing of Maori and Tahitians. And he was astonished by this unmistakable evidence for the relatedness of all of these people. So that relatedness meant that they had somehow started from somewhere. And he correctly intuited that that must have been to the west, to Asia. And he was essentially correct in understanding that people started in Asia and then settled this extraordinary range of islands, and that was almost unbelievable. Understandings did evolve, and I think the key achievement in the 20th century, Rangi Hiroa told the story from the perspective of Maori. It ceased to be a story about other people. It was a story about the achievements of his own people. But what followed that was most critical was the development of radiocarbon dating, and then the beginnings of what we think of as modern scientific archaeology. So it wasn't just that connections were being made on the basis of words or other cultural affinities, but that precise dating of archaeological sites made it possible to begin to tell the story in a much more precise way, in the same kind of precise way that archaeologists had understood the history of the Mediterranean, for example.
A detail here that I smiled and I laughed when I came across it, Professor. Johann Reinhold Forster was on board Resolution for the second Cook voyage. His son, Georg Forster, a very young man, later travels with Alexander von Humboldt. So what we're looking at here is a connection between discovering the Pacific and discovering the Americas. Von Humboldt leads the revelation of nature in Europe. So there's... I know it's too fantastic to credit the South Pacific with all of this, but it is wonderful to see how the same information is turned over and over to come to revelations in other parts of the world that are unknown.
Well, I think, in fact, the Cook voyages were extraordinarily inspiring to generations of scientists in that period, and the Forsters themselves were particularly imaginative writers who wrote very beautifully about the island environments, the distinctiveness of landscape and foliage and tropical light and water and all of these sorts of subjects. And in fact, George Forster was himself an extremely accomplished romantic writer, and his book did have a great influence on Humboldt, among many others. Certainly they were works that promoted a kind of fascination with natural history and the world that was at that time still known to a very partial extent by European scientists.
I want to be keen on one detail. I went too fast over it. The Dutch, in April of 1616, fired on a double-hulled canoe bearing 25 people, and at the same time marveled at the construction of that. That's early, 17th century. Did that information get isolated and not distributed through Europe? Is that why they're always rediscovering the same revelations?
That's right. I mean, information was unsystematically published early on. It was not that it was not published, and that narrative which first appeared in the Netherlands in the early 17th century was translated and republished, so that British explorers were aware of that information, but often the information was vague regarding place and exactly who those people were and where they were when they were encountered and so on. Something changes at the time of Cook's voyages. People begin to develop a deeper familiarity because those voyages ranged so widely. But importantly, also, Pacific Islanders themselves began to know Europeans and know who they were dealing with and interact in deeper ways with Europeans. And that meant that the deep knowledge they themselves had of the ocean, of navigation, of trade, of traditional history, islanders began to share that knowledge with Europeans. And that's what brings us back to John Williams and others in the mid-19th century, who were really learning a great deal from local people who were intimately aware of the ocean, the ways of navigating it, the qualities of that environment.
Now a mystery when we come back. A not quite a map, an archive from Cook's voyages, thanks to a Society Islander, Tupaya, who died too quickly in Batavia of disease on that voyage. But his map, not quite a map, remains a challenge for everybody to understand how this vast landscape was navigated. Professor Nicholas Thomas, the book is Voyagers, the Settlement of the Pacific. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and Professor Nicholas Thomas is here. His new book is Voyagers, many avenues that we've not had time to explore, but now the great big mystery that just sits there and makes you laugh. It's like the Game of Thrones or trying to figure out the world by reading Greek history. All right, here we go. It's a map, not quite a map, constructed by Tupaia. I say that incorrectly, Professor, forgive me. What are we looking at? Because you reproduce it in your book.
On Cook's first voyage, the ship spent several months off the island of Tahiti, and the British developed close relationships with a host of islanders. It wasn't one of these passing encounters where they exchanged a few things or interacted violently. It was a sustained interaction. And one of the most extraordinary aspects of this interaction was that Tupaia, who was a priest, a navigator, a political player in the dynamics of the Tahitian kingdoms at that time, he was clearly extremely interested in these people who had appeared from beyond the known universe at that particular time. He was interested in why they were there and what they were doing. So he spent a great deal of time with Joseph Banks and with Cook. And when time came for the ship to depart, he wanted to join the voyage. He took a young boy, a servant, with him, and his interest was in visiting England and learning what he could about a society that he knew nothing about before. Cook, of course, was very interested in the geography of the Pacific. There were clearly islands that had never been visited by Europeans. He clearly made inquiries of Tupaia. He tried to learn as much as he could from him. A number of the British had some grasp of Tahitian. They could communicate Tupaia obviously witnessed Cook drawing charts. He witnessed the charts that were used on a daily basis in navigation, and he produced a map, a kind of chart, a diagram, as his contribution to this ongoing inquiry. And that is an extraordinary image of many, many islands in Polynesia, in the Pacific, that Tupaia knew about. And some of those islands bear names that are very easy to recognize and are well-known Polynesian names today in the wider group of the Society Islands and in neighboring archipelagos. Other islands are harder to identify. And consequently, there's been an enormous range of debate that started, in fact, not long after the return of Cook's ships, but that has carried on, especially more recently, that is concerned really to make sense, to interpret the clearly extraordinary knowledge that Tupaia had of the geography of the Pacific and understand exactly what the chart itself represents.
Because the chart is not a map as we understand it, if I read you correctly. It may be a series of of island names that are a way of remembering or indicating to another generation. Is that how to regard this? Is this if he's a professor teaching?
Yes, it's a diagrammatic representation, and some islands are clearly clustered. It's not considered a sort of representation of traditional knowledge. It's seen rather as something quite remarkable. Tupaia saw that Europeans were making maps, so that he made something that looked like a map that set out his understanding of a range of islands. It's possible that some of the islands that are connected, as it were, by direction, reflect customary understandings, that you might go first to this place and then to this place and then beyond. It's certainly the case that he had voyaged widely himself. He had probably been to archipelagos distant from the Society Islands. He may have been as far as the Tongan Islands himself. But we don't really know, and it's clear also that people have geographic knowledge at a number of different levels. So there are places that they know about because they know them through tradition or history. There are places that they know about because people visit them even if they haven't visited them personally. And there's places they know because they have been on voyages there themselves. And this chart probably reflects an amalgam of that sort of understanding. Despite the complexities of understanding it, there's absolutely no doubt that it reflects extraordinary geographic knowledge, extraordinary navigational ability on the part of Polynesians of the late 18th century.
Professor, my final thought here is that what we're dealing with is a fresh field for the 21st century, because there's so many places that have been left unexplored for pottery, for leavings of people thousands of years ago. Is that correct? We just have 30 seconds.
The archaeology is advancing very rapidly, but I think what's most exciting is that this is now really a cross-cultural discussion where the expertise of Pacific Islanders themselves is being given space, and we have a huge amount to learn from those people.
Professor Nicholas Thomas of Cambridge University. The new book is Voyagers, The Settlement of the Pacific. This is CBSI on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBSI on the World with John Batchelor.